I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Who polices the police? That's the topic of today's What's Next episode. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White, and I am joined today by Partnership for the Public Good Executive Director Andrea Osuluban and attorney Nick Ramirez from the Western New York Law Center. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I wanted to start our discussion with that question of who polices the police, because it's a phrase we've heard throughout our lives when law enforcement officials and organizations act extrajudiciously or corruptly or in any way that is not up to the high standard that comes with such power. But that is not exactly the context of our discussion. This is in response to news that came down last week from the Buffalo Common Council that a civilian police oversight board is essentially dead in the water at this time. So Andrea, I want to pose this question to you again. Who polices the police?
Yeah, right now in Buffalo, as unfortunately in many cities around the U.S., really the police are policing themselves through internal affairs. They investigate resident complaints of misconduct. And for us, that's really where the process ends. And as has been widely reported here and in other cities, internal affairs almost always finds in favor of the officer and finds, you know, no basis for misconduct in many, many resident complaints.
So what we are looking at here is striving for some sort of independent board that can, you know, not necessarily be antagonistic towards law enforcement, but work with law enforcement to try to change policy. Nick, I want to bring you in here. Where do you stand with Minority Bar Association of Western New York in trying to gain some independence?
Well, Minority Bar Association of Western New York, I am a former co-chair of the Criminal Justice Reform Task Force. But like a lot of organizations, just the time to push for these things, to push for civilian oversight, it just seems to have passed. You know, there was a lot of effort for it, a lot of work from me and the people I work with, you know, Miles Grisham and Sam White especially. But over that time, we've had to redirect our focuses because it was pretty clear that there wasn't the political motivation to have this kind of civilian oversight.
And I just want to say, you know, the push for civilian oversight goes way back. PPG released a report with Open Buffalo in 2016 on community policing reforms that could be brought to the city of Buffalo. In that report, we looked back to 2012. President Obama had a task force on 21st century policing, which recommended not having only police-based internal affairs investigations of misconduct, but to have citizen investigations of police misconduct and those types of civilian measures, which would then make discipline recommendations to the chief or the commissioner of police departments around the country. So just to say, like, that's all the way back in 2012. We often rightfully orient ourselves to 2020,
yes,
the police killing of George Floyd, the uprisings that followed, the extensive calls for reform. But there was, of course, a good decade before saying things need to change in policing, in discipline of police, and how misconduct is handled. And so our partners did a lot of advocacy work in the years before 2020 to bring some of those models to Buffalo, but also to reform a tool that we already have. In our city's charter, we have a Commission on Citizens' Rights and Community Relations, which is already empowered to handle complaints about police department employees. Unfortunately, for many years, that board from time to time would not have a staff executive director, would not be fully appointed with the commissioner seats that it could have. It's required in the city charter to issue an annual report, but has not done that since 2020, and at that time it put out a report after not having done it for several years. And so it's unfortunate that we have this body in our charter that should have 11 commissioners, that should take resident complaints, investigate them, has subpoena power, and it's basically defunct for many years.
So what is it going to take to essentially resurrect it?
I've been thinking about that question a lot. I think it's going to require identifying political actors who, you know, legislatures and representatives who also have the willingness to push through on this, because there can be political capital you have to expend to push it, and the interest in pushing it. I think that can be a little difficult because we do still have, you know, a deficiency in having legislatures and representatives who come from communities that have experienced issues. Organizational leadership, some organizations that were pushing for this, they attempts to work cooperatively did not pan out as we would have hoped. And instead what it did was moderate the efforts and put people in the position of saying, we're not going to push on this because we don't want to harm our own connections within these political bodies to make other changes or for personal development so that we can be in positions to make changes. So I think changes in leadership in general in a lot of areas are needed, but I also think a change in how the community understands policing and a more vocal response from the community to the reality of policing is probably necessary.
And Andrea, you mentioned the summer of 2020. We obviously witnessed the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and you know, it was kind of like a crescendo, because we had seen these extrajudicious killings across the country before. Here in Buffalo, we had protests downtown, which turned violent, but we had many more protests and teach-ins after that that were peaceful and proactive. And during that summer, Mayor Byron Brown announced a host of changes to the police department through his reform agenda. Specifics include no longer having emergency response teams respond to peaceful protests, having body cam footage that would be accessible to the public, incorporating a law enforcement assisted diversion program into existing community policy programs, additional de-escalation training for officers, and reforming and restructuring fine and fee schedules to not overburden economically stressed peoples. Have these measures been applied over the past 4 years, as the mayor said?
I would say only a couple of them have happened. And if more have happened, they are not publicly reporting on them, right? And I think that's another role for civilian oversight and the types of possible boards that we're talking about. They can play a role of keeping the public up to date on what changes are happening in the police department, being in discussion with the police department of what still needs to happen. But specifically to that list of reforms in 2020, I have been really eager, so I'm glad you're asking this, Thomas, to see kind of a media scorecard. What has been implemented? What hasn't? Law enforcement assisted diversion that you mentioned is very close to my heart, because Partnership for the Public Good housed a working group to bring a lead program, law enforcement assisted diversion, to Buffalo for about 5 years with Voice Buffalo, Open Buffalo, many organizations, Black Love Resistance, and the rest involved over the years. And what was really unique about it was we had the Erie County District Attorney and the Buffalo Police Department as official members of that working group with advocacy, activists, restorative justice organizations. And that group managed to keep meeting right through 2020, right through the protests. Police captains nominated by the commissioner would be at that table. We worked extensively to bring a lot of information. I should say that what that program does is empowers all officers in a police department to make a diversion instead of an arrest in moments where they feel at their officer discretion, the interaction with police is actually driven by mental health issues, poverty, homelessness, or substance use. And so in those moments, instead of making really an unnecessary arrest that's not going to support the needs of the person, they can make what's called a diversion and call in a case manager, a social work team, help to get a plan in place for that person, get them the referrals that they need. In Buffalo, the vast majority of our arrests are extremely low level. The lowest level drug charge is one of the most common arrests when you look at arrest data in Buffalo. And so again, getting people into case management, into self-directed programs where they can decide is what they really need, a more stable apartment, is what they really need, job training. That's been really proven tool in cities far away like Seattle, but very closer to home and our context like Albany as well. We organized for Buffalo Police to meet the Albany police leadership that had implemented a LEAD program several times and field trips and trainings and back and forth. And long story short, in the end, Mayor Brown announced this in 2020. We have an MOU fully drafted between all those parties I just mentioned with the city's law department. A couple years ago, Common Council even put into the budget money for a LEAD pilot, and it has never been started. And I think at this point, police leadership and Mayor Brown would say, we've taken elements of that program in things like our behavioral health team, but we're not going to do a whole program. And what's a pity about that is that they've taken an approach where really just five or six officers are the ones who are tasked with mental health response and trying to take this approach of alternatives to arrest.
Across the whole city?
Across the whole city, the behavioral health team that concentrates this, that's an important needed program, but usually I think there's about five or six officers in it. I think we have 700 and something sworn officers, several hundred that work as arresting officers. And so we really preferred and made a strong case for a LEAD program because it mainstreams that approach across the department. And I think a lot of the 2020 lessons that we have are, you know, small tweaks to policing are not enough. We need to see overall shifts where police stop acting like warriors, like military in their own communities. They start acting like guardians and community partners that are there to keep everyday residents safe and healthy.
I'd also just like to speak on since 2020, these 4 years later. So a year ago, I was a public defender and also working the reentry unit. And as far as de-escalation, I had many cases I saw where someone would be arrested very violently because they were sitting in the subway for too long. So that doesn't demonstrate de-escalation. And that's just one example. There's many examples I saw where it was very clear that it could have been de-escalated, but instead, you know, as Andrea said, the response was to act like a warrior and decide that violence was the immediate response. With fines and fees, you know, I think that there is a lack of understanding of the impact that even a small fee can have on someone's life when they're living paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. So I think there wasn't a clear indication to me that anyone outside of people from communities that had experienced that could really express that in court and have it be engaged with. Body cams, you know, we had times where we would have six officers on the scene and only one had a body cam, but the onus wasn't on them to explain why the body cams weren't present unless, you know, we decided to cross-examine them on why the other body cams weren't there, and then they would just say, oh, we only needed one. You know, I mean, these are all things that make a lot of sense that we would, and I would have hoped a year ago when I was a public defender, I would have seen some changes from what I would have expected prior to 2020. But instead, what I saw with many of my clients was that none of these things had actually had an effect on people who were just sitting in the subway for too long, and the police decided to arrest them and smash them into the ground for it.
And you have some data about 911 calls. And what do those numbers tell you?
Yes. So at Partnership for the Public Good, we now are part of the Erie County Community Responders Coalition, which again is trying to bring non-police mental health response to the county. And our team did an assessment of 911 call logs. So we got from the county, you know, when people call in 911, what assistance are they asking for? What gets reported back by the officers that the situation was? Over 82% of all 911 calls to Buffalo Police are not about crimes of any type. There's no violence. There's no crime of any type. Shoplifting, you know, loitering, as Nick was describing, no possible crime in the mix. So that's more needs of mental health, very low-level arguments with your neighbor, the dog is barking, the garbage cans are on my side of the lawn, right? Non-emergency medical needs, and lots of these real everyday quality of life issues. Those are generating thousands of 911 calls every year and taking up, you know, endless hours of police time. And unfortunately, often those police responses, you know, I'll tell your neighbor to stop having the dog barking. I'll as a police officer, you know, check in with you about your mental health issue, but they're not really resolving the underlying needs. And in my years of working on police reform in Buffalo, I have spoken with captains and lieutenants that have said, we are responding to all kinds of situations that we weren't trained to do. Police aren't social workers. And some police say we shouldn't be trying to be social workers or ask to respond to all these situations, and really wanting to also expand this more health and care-based response by moving some of these duties and responses out of the police department to community responder teams, social work teams.
We'll continue our conversation here on What's Next after this short break.
Public media is more than Morning Edition and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Buffalo Toronto Public Media creates digital series to ignite curiosity in young learners, free lesson plans, videos, and training for teachers and parents, and events to empower the minds of our community's next generation. This is Public Media.
Robot peer pressure. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is Science Update. Growing up, many of us were warned against succumbing to peer pressure from other kids. But as interactions with robots become more commonplace, could they influence our decisions as well? Ghent University researcher Tony Bell-Paim and his team had children and adults answer extremely easy questions in the presence of cute humanoid robots. Sometimes, a robot would suggest an incorrect answer.
If you give the wrong answer, then we know that you are socially conforming to robots. And it turns out that adults are not sensitive to peer pressure from robots, but children are.
Bell-Paim's team reports in Science Robotics that 74% of children's incorrect answers matched those suggested by the robots. He says that as robots become a bigger part of our daily lives, it will be important to understand their potential to affect kids' choices. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.
Discover the intersection of musical expression and emotional introspection. Listen to Mindful Music, hosted by mental health care worker Carl Shallowhorn. Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. on WBFO.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Kleinhand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits, featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
This is What's Next, and we're discussing police advisory boards and oversight boards in the city of Buffalo with Partnership for the Public Good Executive Director Andrea O'Sullivan and Western New York Law Center attorney Nick Ramirez.
So, as you had said, Andrea, Partnership for the Public Good has been advocating for civilian oversight board and trying to get it off the ground at the city level. Obviously, right now, that's not going to happen. What other options do you have?
Yeah, I think in the long term, we have options like demonstrating what broad public support there is for some form of civilian oversight. And some of our partners, like Voice, Buffalo, the Minority Bar Association, Citizen Action, around 2020, were carrying petitions, trying to get enough signatures to actually get this as a referendum on a ballot in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. So right alongside voting for candidates, you can be asked issue-based referendums and really just getting a sense, voters of Buffalo, do you support civilian oversight of police? And I think that's something that can be revisited. Also, alongside everything we've already talked about, Buffalo Common Council in around 2017-18 created a police advisory board. Mm-hmm. And that body originally was intended to be community residents appointed, have some experience, expertise in some form of restorative justice, reentry, as Nick mentioned, healthcare, social work, folks with these skill sets who could come together and really have discussions with police leadership, bring recommendations for what policy changes were needed. At that time, 2018, you know, as I mentioned, PPG and our partners were asking for things like make every officer a community police officer. Maybe they have to spend 5 hours a week on community policing activities, like going to block club meetings, going to a youth group session. You know, those recommendations sound quaint at this point because 2020 mm-hmm. shifted things.
Right.
And those tweaks are not what advocates wanted. They wanted to fully shift functions out of the police department. So just reflecting, I often think it's a pity that Buffalo didn't do more while we were in that moment to build trust, to show residents that we were going to take a different approach here. But I mentioned the police advisory board because that has had some shifts and some challenges under the Common Council. But, you know, they would have the power to reinvigorate at least that kind of Common Council convened advisory board. Also in 2020, folks on the police advisory board at the time, Dejan Hall, a wonderful advocate from Buffalo, mm-hmm. who now works for the Rochester Police Advisory
Yes, he
Board,
does.
Because they're doing it differently there. I think he's head of policy there, which is wonderful. Aaron Carmen, who's a professor at Damon, and Danny Johnson, who's a wonderful community advocate and who works at UB. Those three actually wrote a brief for the Common Council on what civilian oversight could look like in Buffalo and had a couple models that they recommended. So again, all these proposals are out there from community organizations, from experienced researchers, from local lawyers and academics that could be picked up again.
So what has happened to the advisory board?
The advisory board, I think, experienced you know, growing pains like a lot of political bodies and community bodies do. The Common Council, I think back in 2022, ended up dissolving what was in place at the time and reappointing a new structure. You know, part of what happened there, from my outside perspective, we advocated to get that board created in the first place with the idea that police leadership would meet with that board, hopefully on a monthly basis. And for example, month one could be, what's the city's body camera policy? At the time that board was created, they didn't have one yet. You know, what's best practice from other cities? What do we want to see? Month two could be, Again, best practices in community policing. Month three could be at the time in 2018, the City of Buffalo Police Department was not accredited. They were not doing any performance reviews. There were no annual performance reviews of police officers for years in the City of Buffalo. That was something that amazingly they negotiated into the union contract, and that meant that the city was not eligible for national accreditation as a kind of functioning certified police department because you have to do those reviews. They have changed that since. But just for an example, we were aware of all these topics that could be discussed with police leadership and these community representatives to lead to some policy changes. But, you know, Common Council did not leverage their power at the time to get police leadership to this advisory board. So essentially, my reading is police leadership refused and said, I'm not going to meet with these community members. This would be not a useful of my time. Common Council kind of rolled along with that. And so this group really became more outside activists and had to really protest and had to fight to be heard instead of being a collaborative policy mechanism that could have been seen as a resource by the police department. What do these experienced representative community advocates think needs to change? But they did not come to the table to have that conversation. And that I would also say is kind of a theme in the struggles for police reform in Buffalo. So many groups have research, have experts from other cities, or have direct experiences from residents like the folks that Nick has represented in legal proceedings who have experienced abuse and violence and misconduct. But if you ask for meetings over and over with the mayor's office or with police leadership and you're not given those meetings and they won't have conversations with you and they won't look for change, really as outside folks, you're left with protest and with legal action as your only options. And so we know that there's over 7 or 8 years at this point, a lawsuit led by Black Love Resist in the Rust, which the Law Center is a co-counsel on, over bias and racial bias in police checkpoints in Buffalo. That's just one example.
I did have some attempts to speak with legislatures and representatives about, you know, civilian oversight in a couple different law enforcement capacities. And one of the first things that I would be asked in those meetings was, well, have you reached out to them yet? Have you talked to them about what they want? And that them referring to whatever law enforcement body we had asked to have the meeting about. And it would be, you know, again, this circular thing where, okay, so we got to go talk to them first, but then they're not meeting with us or they're just not interested in hearing from us. And then we try to talk to the, you know, representative or legislature again, and it's, well, talk to them first because, you know, they're trying to do all these changes and I think you can work together, but then they just won't talk to us and we don't see the changes. And I think the option that we had, and I'm lucky enough that I was working with experienced civil rights attorneys like Michael Higgins and Heather Abraham at the Civil Rights Clinic at UB. Shout out for any law students out there. I highly recommend it. Where our next step then was to use the existing transparency laws and to obtain records about issues like people dying in the jails, police stops. So like Andrea said, I think that, you know, once you've exhausted trying to go through the legislatures, legal action to bring things to light is the next option. And I think that the things that we bring to light can then galvanize more people in the community because it's seeing these things happen that leads people to think maybe police can't police themselves effectively.
Where have we seen progress? I mean, we've run down a lot of things that haven't happened, but I mean, I look at things like bolo wraps and shot spotters that were ideas that were promoted by law enforcement that were essentially shut down by community advocates. Is there any other areas where we have seen something like that?
So my predecessors in the Minority Bar Association's Criminal Justice Reform Task Force, I've already mentioned a few of them, but I'll also throw Limwood
yes
in there. He's just fantastic attorney. Also fun to watch in court if you ever get the chance.
And fun Anne-Marie interview Richmond, too.
Anne-Marie Richmond, experienced civil rights attorney, and all of them together actually passed the right to know law in Buffalo, requiring police officers to inform you of your right to refuse a search and requiring that they give you their name, their badge number when they stopped you. We used to refer to it as Miranda rights for your vehicle. In the public defender unit, that is huge. A lot of places don't have that kind of requirement. And for us, it was something to keep an eye out for when we needed to challenge a search. I think I successfully got a case dismissed because they didn't do that. And it was a guy who was really just tired from work and he got to go home and he got to sleep. So I definitely wanted to make sure I mentioned that as one place we've seen progress.
Now, some would argue that the police department has mechanisms of oversight in place already. Internal Affairs, a Citizens' Rights and Community Relations Commission. Are those enough mechanisms? Are they enough to satisfy civilian oversight advocates?
I would say no. And the reason is that they are all internal to city government, internal affairs within the police department. The Commission on Citizens' Rights and Community Relations, which I mentioned earlier, has 11 seats that are appointed by the mayor. And so those have not been being appointed. But even when they are, there's a consideration of, are they political? It was curious to me in the news recently that I think Police Commissioner Grimaglia was saying, we hesitate around civilian oversight because it's so political, which residents get a seat. But we can certainly say the same thing about a board that is heavily appointed by the mayor. So I think folks really want to see something that is a little more independent, that does not all loop back through internal affairs investigations, which we know very much find in favor of officers. I will say also to the point of progress, there have been one or two officers fired by the department this year that have been widely covered in the news. And that is unusual. Mm-hmm. Previously news stories have basically been, you can have 34 internal affairs complaints, you can have on camera terrible instance of verbal abuse of residents, and you don't get fired. You get suspended. Maybe you get back pay when you mm-hmm. get reinstated. And, recently an officer, Investigative Post has covered this a lot, was fired earlier this year. So that's a shift. We have also made a lot of arguments that the city has power to discipline police officers that it's not currently using. The mayor, the police commissioner have power in the city charter to take the lead on police discipline. They argue that that has been negotiated away in the collective bargaining contracts with the police union. And yet there are court decisions from the New York State Court of Appeals saying you can't bargain that away. That if it's in your mm-hmm. city charter, the contract with the union doesn't matter. If the charter places the police commissioner in charge of discipline, you have that power today, no matter what. And so far they've said, we don't really agree with that, but I feel by actually firing a couple officers, having that in the media, are they starting to claim that power a little bit more?
I'd also like to say, I definitely don't think it's enough to have it be internally based. And I liken this to myself as an attorney and other attorneys. Your field, you have a culture within it. And so for a lot of attorneys, and we've seen some attorneys in the press, that the public is like, what, this person's a lawyer? Are you kidding me? And the rest of us immediately feel like, well, let's try and explain it. Maybe, that's because we have this shared culture. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, law enforcement can have that shared culture where it's not an intentional necessarily that they're not looking at this as a violation or, from the perspective of the person who may be harmed. It's because, they're all thinking within that same culture and within that same beliefs. And so when they see something like an officer that the rest of the public is like, this is outrageous, they try to think, well, maybe there's explanations because they think of their culture and they've internalized all of the ways that they would approach things. So you have to have an outside body that isn't ingrained and has that immediate idea of explaining bad behavior as consistent within the culture to offer that just reality check. And mm-hmm. I think that we're missing that when we assume that there's something so unique about policing that no one who isn't a police officer could possibly understand. We get very close to the idea of saying we have to have blind trust in the police mm-hmm. and just assume, don't ask questions. I think we need to ask questions, and the only people who are going to be able to ask those questions in a way that might detract from what a police officer would think are people who aren't working as police officers, because they're going to be seeing it from a different cultural view.
Mm-hmm. We'll be back with more What's Next after this.
Hey, educators. You've been asking for it, and it's here. Reading Rainbow Stories is ready to help your students stay on track. Each story is paired with activities to help students strengthen cross-curricular skills such as math and business in Lemonade for Sale.
Let's keep track of our sales.
Science and health in Germs Make Me Sick.
Usually, you feel better after a day or two.
Thanks.
But if you don't, you should see a doctor.
And history in Following the Drinking Gourd.
One of the worst things about slavery is that families were separated. Fathers, mothers, and children were oftentimes sold to different people.
Check out the new Reading Rainbow Stories collection on PBS Learning Media today to help your students stay on track.
Hey, is this thing on?
Test, test, 1, 2.
Sounds great. Let's go.
The podcast world is overflowing with more than 750,000 podcasts to choose from.
But for great local podcasts, you can now go to one place, the new Amplify BTPM Pods app. Here you can discover content produced in Western New York and Southern Ontario, our own backyard.
With a wide variety of genres to choose from, there is something for everyone.
Listen to the best independently produced podcasts in the region anywhere, anytime.
Download the free Amplify BTPM Pods app wherever you get your apps and begin exploring your local podcast community now.
Hey people, I'm Corey and this is Compact Civics. One thing about me, I love voting. Voting for pizza over wings, going to this movie or that. But what I love most is casting my vote in an election.
What's one vote when so many people
vote? My
vote
doesn't really count. Can one vote really make a difference?
All right, all right. I hear your doubts, but yes, it really can. Check this out. In 2002, a police officer in Washington State was running for the primary in the State House of Representatives. Out of nearly 12,000 votes, he came up one vote short. And here's the kicker. A fellow officer and friend, possibly former friend, forgot to mail in his ballot and left it sitting on his kitchen counter next to his water bill and half-eaten toast. Also in 2002, Esmeralda County in Nevada held an election for commissioner. It ended in a tie. And in the most Nevada thing ever, the tie was broken by having the candidates pick the highest card from a deck of playing cards. And right here in Western New York, the town supervisor election in Barry in Orleans County came down to a narrow 5-vote difference. There are more than 2,000 people in Barry, and only 600 people voted. So you see, one is not the loneliest number. It can be one of the most powerful numbers when it comes to our democracy.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
Where do you go when you want news you can trust? WBFO, of course. And when you just want to catch up on the day's news, you can go to the WBFO Brief Podcast. Listen to the WBFO Brief every weekday wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to like and subscribe so you can always stay up to date with the news you need.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your
NPR station. Thanks for joining us once again on What's Next. and we're discussing police advisory boards and oversight boards in the city of Buffalo with Partnership for the Public Good Executive Director Andrea O'Sullivan and Western New York Law Center attorney Nick Ramirez.
With the city, you know, using a little bit of that, of the power they have through the charter, is it a case of they're not using it to its fullest extent because they don't really, they're trying to avoid tussling with the police union?
I think that's right. And, you know, they have said if we fire officers, the union will sue us. And that's happening right now in one of those cases of an officer fired this spring, which is a pity. But I think, you know, the case law is there in New York State. If City Hall, the mayor and the police commissioner want to show residents that they care when officers are abusive, they do not want abusive officers as part of our department, I think you make those terminations and handle the lawsuits. If you move it through the courts, the city is in the right using its charter authority. So I think, you know, the city takes on plenty of other litigation, and this is an area where they should be defending their power if they have to fire officers.
There is one person in the city who is kind of advocating for at least researching the possibility of creating an advisory board, and that's Common Councilman Rashid Wyatt. Is it discouraging that other council members have shot it down?
Definitely. You know, and we really appreciate Councilmember Rashid Wyatt, who has asked for the city's law department to research this, who has wanted to have cost estimates. What should this program look like if we created more civilian oversight? And when I've heard him talk about this, it's very much for him about the trust of residents. How can residents trust a department when, as Nick's describing, you know, it's all internal investigations. Residents are seen as folks that could never understand the business of policing. So really to build that trust. And, you know, Council Members Wyatt is right. I think the research really shows communities that have civilian review have higher levels of trust in their local police departments. You know, they start to better understand policing because they're able to come and voice their concerns, hear feedback from a civilian board, discuss what policy changes should happen. So I think, you know, this notion that we hear from our current police commissioner, from Mayor Brown, of it's not helpful because law enforcement is this niche professional area and citizens won't know about it. Well, they certainly won't know about it if you shut them out of discipline work, if you shut them out of having the statistics, having the data, understanding the program. So I think a lot more work to open up transparency, to engage communities around police work, what they want to see, what works, what doesn't, can help shift things as well.
Yeah. And I think it's also just disheartening, period, that they're not even willing to do the research. But a lot of the things you hear in response to the idea of doing research seem to assume what the outcome would be. To me, that just shows an unwillingness to actually engage with the reality. It's, you hear them saying like, well, you know, it's police that have this unique approach and we, you know, oh, we see civilian outcomes that they sometimes match. And well, you're assuming all of that. But why can't we do the research to see if your conclusions are bared out? You know, the just not even passing anything, just doing research on it and hesitance to do that to me is very disheartening.
Would we consider having a advisory board with disciplinary powers? Because I know what happened in Rochester, but the police union successfully sued the city to remove the board's disciplinary powers.
Yeah, I think that's complicated. And I think also, you know, that's some of the hesitation for other council members for sure is what power will we be giving these everyday folks? You know, in many, many models, residents who are on the civilian board have the power to investigate, have the power to call in officers and interview them about alleged misconduct. And then they essentially are submitting recommendations to the police department or to City Hall and the mayor for what discipline should happen. So I think that's all parts that can be debated and researched. You know, as Nick said, do the research. Do we want to have a civilian board that has binding disciplinary powers? Do we want to have a civilian board that makes recommendations, as is often the structure? There's even a structure in certain cities where there is a resident board that audits the internal affairs process and outcomes. So they might not be the first rung. They're not doing the investigations in that case, but they have an expert citizen board that can look at what has been the internal investigations process. Was it fair? Was it thorough? Was there bias? So there are so many models for this. Unfortunately, the response we have from our top leaders in Mayor Brown and the police commissioner is simply that it's not helpful because, as we've said, they say civilians don't understand the nature of police work. But I think from the block clubs we visit, from the residents we work with, everyday people know what makes them safe. They know if they trust their community police officers or not. And if you build that trust and residents feel comfortable calling police when something is happening, reporting things, having a rapport with police, that can make communities safer. So to really cut residents out of the picture, I think, is part of our core problem in Buffalo, is why they struggle to solve violent crimes that do happen, right? People do not feel protected. They don't feel that sense of trust. They don't feel that their voices are valued. And it's not hard to imagine why. They're being expressly told, you could never understand police work, so why would we include you in this conversation?
I think that any civilian oversight board needs to have disciplinary powers at this point. And it goes back to, like Andrea was saying, the idea of trust. The police have lost the trust of a lot of the public. And if they want to get it back, then they've got to go through some time where police, a civilian board, can discipline the officers and earn that trust back to the point where we'll maybe revisit that option after a few years of having it so that police are fired by civilian oversight board. And we see changes, then maybe we revisit it. But for right now, they've lost so much trust that I think it is necessary that there's an accountability measure that tells people, like, that there's not going to be this deference anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now with that though, wouldn't the police union or the city itself argue for some sort of veto power?
I'm certain that they would. I would expect them to, and it's probably not a bad idea for them to ask for that. And maybe you can hash something like that out. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be some sort of review after it.
Mm-hmm.
If you fire someone, they can maybe have that reviewed as it is right now. If you think someone fired you improperly, wrongfully, you have options for recourse. The problem is that we don't even have the risk of officers being fired improperly. What we seem to have is erring on the side of not taking any disciplinary action unless you can be absolutely 100% certain with video cameras on every moment of it that disciplinary action should be taken.
What can we learn from what has been achieved in Rochester, Albany, even across the country in Seattle, other places where advisory boards seem to be working well? What can we learn from what's happening in other places?
I think, we can see that these boards can function well. Rochester has actually built a really impressive structure that has multiple employees. That's another piece that we should mention. I think these boards need a little bit of staff support, research support, funding to carry out their role. Very often locally, we see things like the Common Council Police Advisory Board, the Erie County Legislature's Commission on Corrections, mm-hmm. which is appointed community members. And those folks are all volunteers. And also, there's like no staffing, support, research, funding for them to move the work forward. So in one sense, it's very hard to succeed when that's happening. So I think looking to some of the structures where they have investigators, researchers, policy folks supporting the insights, the direction of the residents appointed to the board is really important. And then we can see and hear from folks that public confidence in law enforcement can increase when residents have this stronger voice in policing, when we don't have the sense, as you started us out today, that police are policing themselves. There are not many areas of organized labor where you can handle your own disciplinary procedures exclusively like that. So I think that could be an important shift.
I think the biggest takeaway, and I've shared this with many of the law students, interns, and my colleagues, is that we can't give up, because maybe it's not happening right now. It's going to take work, but we've seen that it can happen and that changes can be instituted even if they're done incrementally, even if they take more time. So I try to remind everyone that maybe it's not happening. We're not seeing this right now. That doesn't mean we should stop working towards it, because maybe it's just going to take us a little longer. But the fact that it has happened in other places should give us some hope, and we can use things that they've done to support our own efforts and use that as something to drive us.
I think that's so important, Nick, too, because also we may well be moving to a mayoral transition in Buffalo, right? There's mm-hmm. plenty of talk that Mayor Brown may retire at the end of this term. And so I think for residents to again come together, it's exhausting, but to again, after many years of doing this, come together and really make this a public priority, it's an important moment to do that.
So what's next for Partnership for the Public Good on this front? And then, Nick, I'll ask you about the Minority Bar Association of Western New York. What's next for them?
So for us, right now, we have really focused our justice reform efforts on the county and state level, in part because things are so entrenched in the city. And as we've said, there's not a lot of political leadership to try these proven methods. So as I mentioned, we are a co-chair of an Erie County Community Responder Coalition, which is working to launch community responder teams without police to respond to nonviolent calls about health and social needs. And so this is kind of like a fourth arm of first response. Police should exist to address crime. Firefighters are there to stop fires. Paramedics are there for medical emergencies. And these community responders can be there for health and social needs. And so we've been working extensively with partners, again, Voice Buffalo, Black Love Resistance, the Rust, Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition, and others to bring this model here. And that's progressing. I'm really hopeful that we'll have kind of the first pieces of some pilot programs for that in some Buffalo neighborhoods over the next year.
Good. And Nick?
Well, as far as Minority Bar Association goes, the Criminal Justice Reform Task Force is kind of on hold right now, just kind of reevaluating. I've stepped down from my role, and so I'm not sure if they're what the active efforts are. I can say myself, as a civil rights attorney, I'm working with a lot of people that are working on policy changes. Continuing policy advocacy with fair fines and fees, litigation, impact litigation to address problems. And there's a couple recently graduated law school students, and I'll just mention one, Glenn A. Mercado, fellow Boricua, who I know we've talked about continuing in our efforts in advocacy. Not a specific organization, but I'll say there's a lot of people out there right now who are just going to get into the fight and the push, and I'm hopeful for the future.
You're listening to What's Next, where we have been discussing the idea of a civilian police advisory board in the city of Buffalo. an idea that now seems to be gone with the wind, but the fight continues. I want to thank my guests, Partnership for the Public Good Executive Director Andrea Osuluban and Minority Bar Association of Western New York member Nick Ramirez for joining us today. You're listening to WBFO News and Buffalo, Toronto Public Media.